Welcome back to The Lars Resort, which remains a podcast with me, Lars Evertson, brought to you still by Betson. And it is a Thursday. It's a what a week it's been in the world of Premier League football. I mean, what do we call this episode, huh? There's so many ways to go. The coefficient emergency pod. And then there was the weekend before with the dramatic twists and turns in the title race. Good Lord. I mean, I timed this quite well, I guess. I had a big rundown of what I thought would happen in the title race last week. And then we immediately had to throw out a lot of those notes because things changed quicker than anticipated. Though not, you know, in a way that was entirely unanticipated. I think before we get to last night's dramatic events in Europe, I think we need to address the Sunday very, very briefly. Sunday, which I believe we should forever now call Slip Up Sunday. With both Liverpool and Arsenal dropping points in the title race, you may feel like you have chewed and digested this already, because there's been a few days. But no, let's just very, very quickly look at this, because this started with Liverpool against Palace at Anfield. Which was another game, really. I mean, really, that game followed a very typical Liverpool pattern of this season, which is it was another game in which Liverpool produced quite a lot going forward, quite a lot of good chances, but were vulnerable at the back. But of course, the big change, the big difference from earlier is they didn't score, which hasn't been an issue. I mean, we've well, not recently. We've missed with this one twice in a row now. But there has Liverpool to win and both teams to score has been a reliable bet this season, because they always do this of give the opponent some chances and then they produce so much going forward that they get there in the end. And I thought this was going to happen again. So I saw this first half from Liverpool. There was no real panic on my part. I was sitting very pretty with that early Palace goal, wonderfully worked goal by Crystal Palace, some fabulous one-touch football there, and I thought, yes, here we go, because Liverpool are going to come back and win this, and the bet will land. So I was feeling pretty good about that. But this is something new that Liverpool are doing now, that they just don't score, I guess. They kept producing. I mean, in the games against Manchester United, Atalanta, and Palace, Liverpool had 68 shots for a combined XG of around 9, or some such, and scored 2 goals and got 1 point from those games. I mean, this is not really a point situation in the Europa League, but let's say, yeah, 1 draw and 2 defeats and 2 goals from a 3-game stretch where they had 68 shots and a huge XG. So, I mean, we had the big Darwin Nunes chat. I don't feel like we need to have it again. And again, I don't think he was the biggest culprit either. You had Mo Salah, again, being more wasteful than we're used to seeing. The Curtis Jones miss was very painful across these games. We've had some Diaz misses. It just seems that the sort of composure has left him. And I've said again, I hate talking about finishing, because it's such a... What can you say? They've lost their composure. They don't appear to have the sort of the head in the freezer that you need in front of goal. Maybe this is all the energy, the emotional situation of this is Jurgen Klopp, we got to do it for Jurgen. Maybe that is kind of proving too much of a thing. I don't know. All of this thing we do after games like this, we sort of grasp around for explanations as to why very good footballers that usually kick the ball into the goal when they have a chance to do so, in this case, did not kick the ball into the goal. And I've yet to hear, like, I feel I struggle to find convincing explanations for that. And I don't think I've ever seen any sort of interesting research or good theories as to why variations in finishing happens. I mean, it seems to be such an individual thing anyway. But yeah, Liverpool's finishing has deserted them at a point in the season when they really needed for it to not to. And you can talk about defensive deficiencies. Palace had, more, even by Liverpool standards, they allowed Palace more chances than you really should in this game. But they still created enough that it would have been fine, except ball not go into goal, which is a big problem. And it was apparently the 21st time this season that Liverpool has conceded first, which seems bad. Like, all these turnarounds are exciting to watch and they're great fun, but at some point, like, if we're in April still and you've conceded first 21 times this season, some things are not going quite right, I guess. They created enough chances to get away with it again, but they did not. And it was not entirely unexpected. I mean, I did say during my big sort of title race rundown that I had this sort of vague lack of trust in Liverpool. I didn't know exactly when they'd mess up in that run-in, but I had a feeling they would at some point. Arsenal, I felt kind of differently about. Well, I certainly also felt that I'm not convinced they'll win every game, but I did not think for a second that they would lose at home to Villa. Now, I find this game more inexplicable than the Liverpool one. Because, yeah, maybe, with Liverpool keep giving their opponents chances, at some point, efficiency in front of goal might fail them and you get into this sort of problem. But Arsenal have been just had a run of games in the Premier League where they've been so in control of things, you know? Before this game against Villa, they'd conceded just 2 in their last 8 games in the Premier League and looked so composed and on top of things. They were hosting a Villa team that were missing Kamara, as I keep harping on about, that he's a big miss for them. Luiz was suspended, so you had the sort of Yuri Tielemans, John McGinn midfield, and they're good players, don't get me wrong. But they're not exactly defensive powerhouses, any of them. They're not elite sort of ball winners there. I wonder if that's why Arteta felt he could move Havertz into midfield again, because he thought the sort of the midfield you're coming up against is looking perhaps a little lightweight. So maybe he thought, well, we're probably going to boss this one. We're probably going to have possession. So that's another game for Havertz as an 8. But either way, It was a game where Arsenal had, they were playing really well in the first half. They were creating chances. They should really have been ahead, but they weren't. And the second half is just very, very hard to explain, right? I guess there is one explanation, which it feels unsatisfyingly simplistic, but I think it might be right. I think they might be tired. I think this is what we're looking at, because they were so, like, they were dominant in the first half. Ødegaard was playing beautiful passes. It looked okay. Villa carried a threat on the counter, but it looked like this will be fine. Like, at halftime, I was thinking Arsenal are going to just raise their game a couple of notches in the second half. They're going to put Villa under a lot of pressure, and it just didn't happen. They just didn't raise anything, and they were meek. And just when you expect them to really go for it and kill the game, there's just nothing more coming from them. And Villa started bossing things, which I didn't see coming at all. Now, the tiredness thing, that is the most logical thing to me, and it's hard to really prove one way or the other. But I had a brief look at the total minutes played in all competitions this season, and if we compare it to Man City, which I guess makes sense because City are kind of the form team in the league, at least for now, City have got 3 players who have played over 3,400 minutes. That's Foden, Rodri and Diaz. They're over 3,400 in all competitions. Arsenal actually have 6. Saliba, Gabriel, Rice, Ben White, Ødegaard and Saka are all over that 3,400 minute threshold. So they have, their main guys have had less rest than what Guardiola has been able to do, even though they've, you know, also been going deep into the Champions League. As FPL players will know, City are a bit of a nightmare there, because the Pep roulette is forever spinning. You know, good players will be benched seemingly for no reason and with no significant period of notice. This has always been a problem, and it is something he does throughout the season, maybe with the hope that they'll keep a little bit fresher for this period that we're going into now. Certainly Arsenal look to me like they were running out of steam a bit. We don't really have access to good pressing stats for all competitions. This is annoying to me. But I'm looking at Arsenal's PPDA. As we've discussed before, it's a decent way of measuring whether you're effective at disrupting the opponent's build-up game in their half. It's a very coarse way of measuring if you're pressing effectively. And Arsenal's PPDA is lower than City's this season, which does suggest that they're pressing more, at least more effectively. So they've played slightly more minutes, more guys have played more minutes, and they're pressing a little bit more than City, I think. So it might be that Arteta has just kind of asked too much of them physically. That is one possibility. Now, of course, we could be going overboard with this. It's strange. It's just City are just 2 points ahead. There are 6 games left. But it just kind of feels, yeah, on paper, that would be a silly situation in which to write off the competition. It just kind of feels like we've seen this one before, doesn't it? And the betting market certainly thinks so. The odds on City to win, it wasn't it 250 before the weekend? I think I covered that. I quite liked that price. That's all the way down to 140 now. Like, that is a huge swing. It seems to be that the odds compilers and the markets are kind of thinking this is City going to do it now. Certainly the dynamic has changed in a big way. Now, that was Sunday. If that wasn't dramatic enough, slip up Sunday, then came Calamity Wednesday. Does that work? Trash Wednesday? That kind of... It's like maybe a bit harsh. It wasn't all trash. Listen, it's the quarterfinal of the Champions League. It's difficult. Now, if I had any kind of residual sort of smugness in me, because I did kind of call that I still like City to win the Premier League, and then that seems more likely after slip up Sunday. If I was feeling smug about that, then reality gave me a big cold slap in the face with a fish or something when the Champions League came around. Because as you'll remember, I was pretty high on both City and Arsenal's chances to progress there. And let's do Arsenal first. Again, oddly flat performance against Bayern. Now, I was primarily watching City, but I was keeping an eye on things in Bavaria as well. And it just seemed like they couldn't really get going. Bayern away, of course, it's not an easy thing to do, far from it, but this is a Bayern team that has not been playing well recently or this season. Okay, maybe they have a different focus, more of a focus on the Champions League since their league campaign has gone the way it has, but this is still a Bayern team that threw away a 2-0 lead to Heidenheim not that far ago. They're not in a good place, but again, Arsenal just seemed a little bit flat here. Now, Tuchel did something clever. I looked this up, I've done research. Arsenal in the Premier League, 40% of their attacks come down the right-hand side, down their right. Now, only Chelsea and Sheffield United have a higher percentage of their attacks down the right in the Premier League. So, this kind of confirms what I think we already know, is that Arsenal have maybe a slight over-reliance on Bukayo Saka. Like, he is a big part of their sort of attacking, you know, impetus. He generates a lot of their attack, and they know that, and they look for him all the time. So Tuchel did something clever. Alphonso Davies not available, so he played Mazraoui there, played a right footer at left back, so that when Saka wants to cut inside, you have a right footer going with him. And then he played Guerrero, who is kind of a left back. He's played left back, he's played wing back, he's also played as an attacking midfielder. He's an extremely attacking left back, but he is kind of a left back, playing ahead of him. So you kind of had double fullbacks on that flank against Saka, and that seemed to work quite well. So I don't love, as you know, single game XG as a metric. It's too many like potential flaws in there, but I note that Arsenal recorded their third lowest attacking XG number of the season in this game. Second lowest was actually, when I say the season, of the Premier League and the Champions League is what FBref has numbers from. The second lowest was actually in their home win against City back in August. Do you know what the lowest was? The game where they produced the least, according to the XG gods? Away to Porto. Which scans? That was also a very unconvincing display. Now, okay, Porto are well organized and they're defensively sound, but they're a Portuguese team still. And that sounded very dismissive. I don't mean it like that. I have a lot of respect for the gnarly defensive traditions of Northern Portuguese football, and Porto do the thing that they do. But it's still, against City, sure, cagey game. But then Bayern, they've had massive problems defensively this season. I could start listing the names of clubs that have created more, a higher XG against Bayern than Arsenal did in this game, and this would be a long list, and it would include some pretty unglamorous clubs, but let's not get too deep into the weeds of the single game XG. I don't love that metric, but the point is, the games against Porto and Bayern, Arsenal, is it fair to suggest that maybe they didn't look quite as convincing in those Champions League games as they have done domestically? I do wonder if this is where experience comes into mind. I don't love like woolly soft science concepts like that, the experience. Oh, it matters so much that you've been here before. But okay, maybe it does matter a little bit, because this is a team, you have quite a lot of players here who are not used to playing in the Champions League, you haven't done it that much. Maybe that is a factor in those games. I'm not quite sure. Certainly, my feeling is, from the Villa game and the Bayern game, it just kind of looked a bit like they ran out of steam. You know, I don't think it's fair to talk. I mean, I'm sure the internet, being the internet, people will talk about mental fragility, like they choked or they're frozen or whatever it is. I'm not buying that really. I just thought the team looked flat. Physically more so. It's like Arteta. It's like Arteta's a conductor of an orchestra. and you've gotten to like a climactic part of the symphony, and he's like calling for like a huge sound for the orchestra, a big sort of fortissimo here, with the timpani going and lots of noise, and he's kind of waving his hands, and there's just nothing coming. There's just like a quite tepid mezzo forte coming from the orchestra, just no juice left. That's kind of what it felt like, especially the second half against Villa and against Bayern there. Very disappointing. Again, and they'll need to regroup if they want to hang in the title race and give them a chance in case City slip up domestically. Because I don't think those three games we talked about maybe too much last week against Chelsea, Tottenham and United, you're not going to get through all those three unscathed if they have the energy levels as low as they seem to be in the last two games for Arsenal, or the last one and a half games, really. Because the first half against Villa was fine. Anyway, they don't have to worry about playing in the Champions League, Arsenal, but then neither will Manchester City. Oh my word. If the Arsenal loss to Villa was totally unexpected for me, and the performance against Bayern was kind of unexpectedly flat, I'd say City lost to Real Madrid in the exact way you'd expect City to maybe lose to Real Madrid. Not in the sense that I was expecting it. I clearly wasn't. We have receipts. But if you said to someone who hadn't watched that game, Real Madrid knocked out Man City, how do you think the game went? I think they would be able to guess. Like, the game looked like exactly what it looked like. You know, the City had a bunch of chances. Real Madrid sit back and try to hit them on the counter. City miss a bunch of chances. Real Madrid take it extra time. You know, that sort of thing. That sort of trajectory. I have to say, I bristle a little bit at all the talk of this being, you know, it's a tactical masterclass from Carlo Ancelotti. I mean, really? Was it Ancelotti's brilliant tactical plan to concede 33 shots? Like, I'm not sure about this. I feel like this is a little bit of outcome bias, which we're all guilty of to some extent. But come on. Jude Bellingham gave a very interesting interview after the game, and he made the point that some teams play with a very clearly defined system and very fixed positions, whereas Real Madrid play with more freedom. And that seems to be true. You know, City, of course, a very positional team. Pep Guardiola, a big sort of the juego de posición thing. I think that everyone has to be in the right space, and you're not like, you don't have a lot of freedom within that. And Real Madrid are more sort of Ancelotti, yeah, you know, go forth and do what you want. But I'm not sure that really applies to this game, because it did seem to me that Real Madrid spent most of it in the defending in quite a low block, where the positions looked pretty fixed to me, as they just had to kind of sit back and take it. Now, it was a classic Man City Champions League elimination, in the sense that they had a bunch of chances, spent almost the entire game trying to break down a very defensive opponent, miss all those chances, and then get punished. I mean, we've seen this film before. There were several players who either missed chances like De Bruyne or went missing like Phil Foden. So there's plenty of blame to go around, but I think it's inevitable that Erling Haaland will be a talking point, because I don't think a big part of the reason why they bought him was for games like that. When City are doing pretty much everything right, when they're dominating the opponent, getting into good areas, but they just can't get the ball across the line. Part of why he was brought in, I think, was to fix that. And last night he didn't. Like, you can't get away from that. Now, firstly, should be said, there's no hiding from it, he's clearly not having a good season by his standards. He's still favourite to be the Premier League top scorer. He's 150 with bets on to finish top scorer. Cole Palmer is all the way out at 450. Ollie Watkins at 7. So the betting market's still heavily favouring Haaland. But he has missed more chances than he usually does. He has underperformed his XG, which he hasn't done before, at least not in the seasons we have XG numbers for. He's obviously very well aware of this, the missed chances. Whether he knows or cares about XG, I couldn't tell you, but he looks frustrated. You know, his body language has never been very subtle. He looks annoyed with himself. He looks frustrated. Now, honestly, that part of his game, his finishing, I'm pretty confident that he will figure out at some point, and that he'll get back into the groove, so to speak. If you have a striker who's overperformed his XG by quite a bit for four straight seasons, and then he suddenly has one season when he underperforms, I think that's more likely that you have a good finisher who's having a bad year than that he's been a bad finisher all along. He just happened to have four unsustainably good years in a row. Like, doesn't make any sense to me. I don't think that's what's happening. I think things are just not breaking for him, and he's gotten a little bit frustrated. Maybe his confidence been knocked a little bit. Things that used to come natural to him look a bit more labored now. You should be very careful with sort of amateur psychology from afar. It's a very dodgy thing to get involved in. But there are moments where you look at Haaland this season where it feels like he's maybe trying a bit too hard, actually, and kind of overthinking things. And instead of just swinging a foot at things in the way he used to, in a sort of slightly more natural way. But in addition to all of this, like, I mean, some of this is on him for not finishing as well as he usually does. But two things can be true at the same time here. The discussion with Haaland tends to end up being, is he just playing badly by his standards, or is he not getting the service? And it seems to me that obviously the answer is yes. Like, both. Both are clearly happening. And there's always been this kind of friction between what is his natural game, the runs he likes to make, the areas when he's the most dangerous, and how City want Guardiola to play, how Guardiola wants City to play, I think we'll say. That friction has always been there. Now, last season, the discussion started feeling pointless because he was scoring so many goals anyway. But that doesn't mean the friction didn't go away. Now, we don't need to go back over that because we've had that discussion so many times. You all know the sides of it. But I think that still exists. And I think it's become, if there was ever a tug of war between what Haaland would prefer in terms of the service he gets and the situations he gets the ball in and how Guardiola wants his team to play, I feel like the tug of war has kind of leaned a little bit towards what Guardiola wants to do this season. I looked up stuff like progressive passes received, like forward passes that he receives and touches in the box. Those values have both gone down from last season, so it does back up this feeling that you get from watching the games that he's not quite receiving as many of the balls that he would like to receive in the situations he would like to receive them. Now, in addition to him being in a little bit of a funk by his incredibly, incredibly high standards. Now, it's always going to be the case at City and most other big clubs. Most big clubs dominate possessions. They push back the opponent, I should say, and they force them to defend deep, which means you don't get a lot of space to work with as a striker. That's something Erling Haaland's just going to have to get used to. But you still have some moments of transition when there is some space, and you can at least try to hit your striker early, and City just almost never do it. And I wonder if, with game after game of Haaland making the runs that he usually makes and the ball just never coming, at some point, I worry that he gets frustrated and he stops making the runs he would normally make. And he just sort of accepts that, oh, well, I guess the life of a City striker is to just kind of spend a lot of his time hanging around and just kind of pinning the defenders back. And he does occupy defenders really well. I think that's an underestimated part of what he brings to City. Like, you have basically two guys in defense who are worried about him at all times. And that kind of helps the team overall in an intangible way. But he does, yeah, it seems like a lot of his life is spent kind of making runs in the box that are never spotted, occupying center halves, while all these short guys play short passes back and forwards to each other. And that must be frustrating. And then when you add to the fact that when the chances come, he's not finishing the way he has been before, I feel like these two factors are kind of reinforcing each other, and it becomes a negative cycle for him. And it's incredible that we're talking about this, but I feel like we kind of have to. But like, he might still be the Premier League top scorer. This is the kind of player we're talking about. He's having these frustrations, and he still might well be the Premier League top scorer. And he missed 2 months of the season with injury, which is another thing I've said before. This does happen in football more than I think we're aware of, is that players can have physical stuff that they just don't tell anyone about. So I do wonder if this is why the fact that he was apparently asked to be taken off last night, according to Guardiola, that was a bit of a surprise to me. It's not very like him to ask to be taken off when there's a good chance that this game goes to penalties. So maybe there's something, he is in a level of physical discomfort that we're not aware of that's affecting him. This is possible. Anyway, we did have a listener who commented that there was too much City and Guardiola chat on this pod. So I do apologize that we've gone down that route again. Felt a little bit inevitable after last night as the double treble was stopped by Real Madrid. A very dramatic turn of events that has left ambitions ruined, and most importantly of all, the coefficient is in the dirt. It's a disaster for the coefficient. What else can we say? There's Europa League tonight, but it's very likely that it'll be Italy and Germany who will get the extra Champions League spot. I I mean, you need both Liverpool and West Ham to overturn those deficits from the first leg, and I just don't see that happening at all. Now, I won't go into that too much, because by the time you listen to this, those games will probably have happened. But let's be very clear. This is kind of embarrassing for English football, I would argue. Like, the Premier League collectively pay out something like £2 billion more in wages than any other other league annually. Okay, there isn't a huge financial gap between the Premier League clubs and the likes of Bayern and Real Madrid and PSG. When you get to the quarterfinals in the Champions League, inevitably you kind of bump into teams that also have a bit of money and have the financial tools to compete with you. But like losing two teams in the group stages and very likely no teams in the semis of the Europa League, like this is kind of bad with all the advantages the Premier League clubs have financially. They can basically, like, with the exception of one tiny little segment of the market, they can almost like pick off any player they want from the rest of Europe, and they can attract the best coaches, and they have been pretty dominant. It is the first time since 2020 that there's no English club in the semis, just the second time since 2017. So it's not like they're serially underperforming here, but I think with all those financial advantages, ending up with your four teams or with your teams just being the third best in Europe on the season's performance, which means you don't get that extra Champions League spot, I mean, that's pretty poor. There isn't really an excuse for it. Like, Newcastle will say, well, we're new at this, we had a difficult group, we're inexperienced at this level. But over the last two seasons, they've had a net spend of close to €300 million. Like, I think Milan's transfer spend in that period, I think, is about a third of that. And I think Dortmund might have made a profit. So, like, financially, the Premier League teams are just in a completely different world. Let's not start comparing Man United to Galatasaray and FC Copenhagen, who they messed up against in the group stage financially. Like, it just becomes ridiculous. And I watch enough Serie A and enough Bundesliga that I feel like I can still say with some confidence that the overall standard and level in the Premier League is still higher, but clearly too many teams have messed up in Europe this season, and it looks very likely that Tottenham could pay the price for that. I don't know. I find that race for fourth incredibly hard to project with any kind of certainty or confidence, because Villa, as I said, do not make sense to me right now. Their numbers have been pretty trashy defensively since the turn of the year, but then suddenly, with key players missing, they turn up at the Emirates and kind of possibly end Arsenal's title hopes. That's a bit harsh, but you know, they seem to have these performances in them still, Villa. And Spurs, of course, sorry, I'm just getting too worked up now. We are going to have a Spurs chat at some point, because Spurs have been a mixed bag recently. Definitely having a Spurs chat very soon. That Newcastle game was awful, really bad. And a couple of things that is just a consequence of the way they play, but one or two trends that are starting to worry me a little bit there. Maybe next week can be the week for a big Tottenham chat. What we also have coming up on the pod, we have recorded a marathon chat with our good friend Torkistan Karlsson, the scout, former sporting director, etc., etc., about his list of the top 39 players aged 21 and younger in the world. It's one of my favorite things that we've done here on the pod. He's updated the list for this season. And as is often the case when I sit down and have a chat with Mr. Karlsson, the chat went long. So I have to spend some time editing that one. The first part will be out early next week, is the plan. I'll have to just edit that over the weekend because it's going to take a lot of time. The weekend betting preview should be up on the Betson website Friday afternoon as usual. Haven't written it yet, but I think I'm going to double check this, but I think I'm looking on double check this. I'm going to look at the numbers again and do some thinking, but I think I'm looking for goals in the FA Cup semi-final. It feels a bit dangerous, you know, Man City. Perhaps they're kind of stung by the Real Madrid debacle. Perhaps they try to shut this game down entirely and we'll get one of those sort of 70% possession, nothing happens, they win 1-0 type of games. That could happen. But Chelsea are such an interesting case. Like, they've played in the league, they've played five games against City, Liverpool and Arsenal, the sort of top three. And as bad as Chelsea have been at times, they've only lost one of those five. And both teams to score has landed in all five. Like, when Chelsea have played these top teams, both teams have scored in all of those games. Now, expanding a little bit on that, if you look at teams that are 12th or higher in the table, Chelsea have played 17 games against those teams and scored in 16 out of them. Villa at home was the one game where they were skunked as our friend Peter would say. But they have been consistent goal scorers against the better teams in the league. I think it's because they're happier countering than they are trying to unlock a low block. They should have chances to counter against City and to do that. I'm a little bit worried about 1-1 because what I want to do here is both teams to score plus over 2.5 goals. Both teams to score, just both teams to score, is priced at 1.58. I just think that's just a little bit low, isn't it? But if you slap on over 2.5 goals, we get 1.87. So even if I'm a little bit afraid of the 1-1 there, but that's a lot of extra juice. So I feel like that's worth the added risk for me. It's also very tempting. I should have checked the price on that. Can I speak and keep words coming from my mouth whilst I look this up very quickly? Because I want to know what is the price for Cole Palmer to score in this game? It's an incredible run of form he's on, and coming up against City kind of feels written in the stars that Cole Palmer will grab himself a goal here. Big Cole Palmer discussion with Mr. Carlson for his list of talents. You might want to check that one out. I was very tempted to say some of the things we discussed, but I'm just gonna not do that. Player goals, here we go. See, I can multitask like the best of them. Anytime goal scorer, Cole Palmer, three times your stake returned. If the joint top scorer in the Premier League, Cole Palmer, gets a goal against his former employers, seems like that could be written in the stars a little bit. Anyway, again, I have several things I wanted to say about Cole Palmer now, but you know what? I'm going to save it. Save it for the Carlson episodes, which are coming. I think there'll be three of them. I think I'll chop that chat into three. So we'll have a fine spread of talking about young players in some detail. And I think, again, always with Mr. Carlson, it's a real education to have him on the pod. I always feel like I learn something from talking to him. I hope you will too from that upcoming episode. Did you learn anything from this pod? I mean, probably not, if we're being real. But I hope this was a pleasant little half hour as we digest Slip Up Sunday and the calamitous, the coefficient calamity, as we will call it, of what happened in the European football. A reality check maybe for the Premier League teams, a reminder that while they have a lot of money, there are still other good teams around there in Europe. Perhaps a reality check for arrogant Premier League focused people such as myself, who confidently predicted that both Arsenal and City would go through. Turns out both Bayern Munich and Real Madrid can also play football. Who knew? We've learned that, if nothing else, this week. I'm sure we'll learn more things next week. Thanks for hanging out with me yet again at the Lars Resort. Bye!